If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Why is it that with sparkling water, I'm always playing guessing games with what flavor I'm drinking? Is it citrus? Is it aluminum can flavored? Not sure. Sparkling ice, though, they really mean flavor. Like in-your-face flavor. Orange mango, black raspberry. Don't even get me started on the strawberry lemonade. Kiwi strawberry slid right into my taste buds' DMs last night and let them know who's boss. No subtleties there, and no sugar either. But it does have vitamins and antioxidants. Find sparkling ice at a major grocery store or club retailer near you. Sparkling ice. Anything but subtle.
Atlassian software like Jira, Confluence, and Trello help power global collaboration for all teams, so they can accomplish everything that's impossible alone. Because individually we're great, but together we're so much better. That's why millions of teams around the world, including 75% of the Fortune 500, trust Atlassian software. Learn how to unleash the potential of your team at Atlassian.com. That's Atlassian.com. Atlassian.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Revealed. With parachuting monkeys, volcanic eruptions, and stirring performances of Beethoven's symphonies, Surrey Zoo was no ordinary Victorian attraction. Dr. Joanne Cormack of the University of Nottingham has written a piece on the zoo for BBC History magazine, and she caught up with Rob Attar to discuss what the story of this eye-opening pleasure park and the rise of zoos more generally can tell us about science, leisure and empire in the Victorian age.
People in Britain had been collecting and displaying exotic animals for many centuries, but where would we see the origins of the modern zoo as we understand it?
In the early 19th century. So London Zoo was our first kind of modern zoo, established in 1828 by the Zoological Society of London. The society's established 1826, and then the zoo opens a couple of years later. The zoo in Regent's Park is kind of quite different from any other menagerie or collection of exotic animals that existed beforehand. So before the Regent's Park Zoo, most collections of exotic animals are often the property of monarchies, so royal collections, and they're not necessarily to do with science and learning and conservation and taxonomy. So these are more recent ideas. So the Zoological Society of London is quite special because it's formed by a society of middle-class learned people who are interested in animals and learning about them in science. And so the London Zoo is really special because then it's sort of a model for proliferation of zoos that we get soon afterwards across Europe and across Great Britain. So we have more kind of societies cropping up, displaying animals outside, which is another new thing, rather than inside in fairly kind of cramped conditions. We now have the animals displayed outside in these large pleasure gardens, or often admitting the public, but sometimes just for the members of a society. So the kind of tone and what they're for has changed a lot in the 1820s with the London Zoo.
And is there any particular significance, do you think, in the timing of this? Does it feed into things like Industrial Revolution, changes in scientific knowledge, maybe kind of imperial changes? Is the 1820s significant in that regard?
Yes, I think so. I think this is all part of a broader 19th century interest in taxonomy and learning and kind of a confidence that we can know the world and we can pin it down and we can write encyclopedia entries about everything, give everything a name and know what it is. So I think there's that aspect. There's new middle class interest in learning and leisure time as well, which feeds into it. And also, as you say, imperialism definitely is an important factor in the proliferation of zoos, because at this time, Britain is at the centre of an expanding global empire, and people and goods and ships are going back and forth between Britain and India and other places around the world. And people are coming back with stories and extracts, writing down images, what they've seen of the flora and fauna of different exotic countries. So there's a real interest in the exotic and a real desire to understand it, and a kind of 19th century arrogance that the best way we can do this is to bring these animals back home, make them endure these very dangerous crossings and put them where we can observe them and learn about them.
So I suppose modern zoos have this dilemma about trying to promote both scientific understanding, but also creating a venue that provides entertainment to help fund them. Is that a dilemma that zoos in the 19th century had to contend with too?
Yes, and we see two different models of zoos in the 19th century. So there's the Regent's Park Zoological Society of London model, which, to begin with, that zoo didn't admit members of the public. It was for its members and is about conservation. And there's still ethical issues attached to that zoo model, because the keepers didn't really know what they were doing. A lot of them were learning on the job. And that was one of the things that surprised me, kind of reading about 19th century zoos, that it was kind of a success story. If this, we managed to keep this animal alive for a couple of months. And so there are ethical issues there, but I think the ethical issues are far less prominent with those zoos than they are with the Surrey Zoological Garden that we're going to be talking about now, because the Surrey Zoo is on a different kind of model, the kind of menagerie style model, which is about displaying exotic animals for commercial gain, really, to kind of titillate the public. To begin with, Surrey had some more lofty conservational aims, but they became far less important as time went on, and the entertainment factor became the real crucial element.
So coming on to Surrey Zoo, which is the main focus of the feature for the magazine that you've written, what were the origins of this zoo?
So Surrey Zoo was founded by a man called Edward Cross. And Cross, earlier in the 19th century, had a collection, a menagerie at the Exeter Exchange, which is on the Strand in London. So a smaller collection of animals, which were all held indoors in fairly poor conditions. I mean, they were poor enough to even be commented on at the time, when kind of animal cruelty wasn't considered in the same way that it is now. But even then, it was criticised. And there was an incident with an elephant named Juni, who got quite aggressive and was held in such cramped conditions that he became too aggressive to control. And they shot him with, I think, 150 or something or so musket shots. And this got really, really bad response in the press. But Edward Cross did pretty well for a while out of this Exeter Exchange collection of animals. And it was visited by Wordsworth and Lord Byron. And he had connections with royalty as well. One of his animals, a mandrill named Happy Jerry, he lent him to George IV to have dinner and smoke his pipe and drink liquor and have some venison. So Cross did well out of his menagerie, but the press responses got worse over time, and he had to come up with a decision about what to do with this collection. And he approached the Zoological Society of London. He wanted to sell the collection to that nascent society, and he also wanted to be taken on as a director of their new zoo. But they didn't want him because he didn't fit in with kind of the aims of the London Zoo. He wasn't interested in conservation in the same way. He didn't have the same reputation. And so in the end, Cross founded the Surrey Zoological and Botanical Institution, co-founded with some other men. And they came together to buy this large pleasure garden and to display Cross's animals. And then it kind of went from there, really.
And so what kind of people were attending this zoo? I mean, today, I suppose zoos attract quite a broad section of society. Was it the same in those days?
It would have been kind of upper middle class and aristocracy as well, especially in the early days of the Surrey Zoological Gardens, because the Surrey Zoo was really quite fashionable. I mean, we shouldn't necessarily see it as inferior to London Zoo in many ways, because it had animals that had never been seen before in Great Britain, and it had very well maintained, like, beautiful gardens. It had quite impressive structures. It had the biggest glass conservatory ever seen in the UK. So it was frequented by royalty, by aristocracy, and kind of upper echelons of, like, middle classes, really. But as time went on, the animals became less important. The gardens got a bit run down, and everything was overtaken by other entertainments beyond the animals. And the clientele became kind of a bit lower class, lower middle class. Tickets came a bit cheaper. Yeah, the clientele sort of changed over time.
And so what were some of the standout attractions they had beyond the animals at the zoo?
Well, they had all sorts of things. And this was one of the things that surprised me and kind of drew me to this particular zoo. Because in the British Library, they have a really large collection of some scrapbooks with loads of images and press cuttings and ephemera around this zoo. And some of the things that the zoo was advertising included dioramas and kind of staged recreations of the eruption of Mount Vesuvius. So you have a volcano erupting, giving off smoke and flashes of light and rumbling noises and lava cascading. And there are large-scale models of whole towns, whole cities like Venice and Edinburgh all being recreated. There's the Siege of Gibraltar being created with real battle shots. There's the temples of Ellora from Hindu mythology is advertised. So another kind of quite colonial theme going on there. And these were the attractions that really kind of took off in the 1840s. So the zoo's established in 1831, and the animals in the 1830s are probably the most important part of the attractions. And then in the 1840s, we get these enormous tableaux being painted and advertised, all the scenery, really intricate models, fireworks displays, advertising kind of the best pyrotechnic displays on offer in Europe at the time. So these are the things that are kind of really the star attractions now in the 1840s.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Spring is a time of renewal, so why not refresh your home with a little help from Blinds.com? Blinds.com invented a better way to shop for custom window treatments. There's no pushy salespeople in your home or inflated showroom prices. Free samples, free shipping, and our 100% satisfaction guarantee can put the spring back into your step and into your home, too. Shop Blinds.com now and save up to 45%. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Do you have a sense from your research of why the animals weren't seen to be enough by this point? Considering these animals were still fairly exotic and wouldn't have been seen by many people in Britain, why did they feel the need to put on this extra entertainment too?
Well, in the 1830s and 40s, there's a proliferation of zoos in Great Britain. Some of them are no longer here, but some of them are. So Bristol Zoo, we have Manchester, Liverpool, Dublin Zoo in Ireland. So all of these zoos come around a similar sort of time. And I think Surrey is trying to stand out as something a bit different. It's competing with all these other places. And most of the other zoos are built on the kind of Zoological Society of London model. They're more interested in conservation and learning. There aren't many zoos that go down the sort of menagerie style in the way that Surrey has, and certainly not to the same scale. So I think it's a way to differentiate itself from other zoos, and also from the other kinds of entertainment going on at the time. In the 1840s, leisure becomes much more important than it had kind of previously, because people have a bit more leisure time. The rise of middle classes have a bit of money to spend. They're going to travel and go places and do things. I think in the 19th century, the kind of the variety entertainments are really popular. So if you go to a musical concert, you're going to hear all sorts of different types of music. If you go to the Great Exhibition in 1851, you're going to see things from all around the empire, and technology and culture and all sorts of things. So I think there is an appetite for variety, which Surrey taps into really well.
In terms of the animals themselves, do we know which animals were the biggest attractions? Is it similar to the kind of animals that all the kids run to see today?
Yeah, I think so. Another thing that struck me from looking through all these scrapbooks was the press reports of the animals arriving and the anticipation of that. And we're expecting this boat with this animal, and it was caught by this person. This is the captain of the ship. This is the tale of its daring capture. And then people would wait for the boat to arrive so they could try and catch a glimpse of the animals. And sometimes they had to bring animals in the undercover darkness to kind of stop people getting in the way. And upsetting them. But yes, I think it is the kind of animals that we'd be excited about today. So the big carnivores. The giraffes were quite an attraction, because there weren't many giraffes in the UK at the time. So we had the first giraffes. There was a race to get the first rhinoceros. And I think London Zoo actually beat Surrey to it. Surrey had a rhinoceros on its way, but it died during the crossing, unfortunately. Those larger animals, elephants, giraffes, lions, rhinoceroses, those are the kind of really exciting ones.
And you mentioned earlier that in his earlier career, Edward Cross had been notorious for how badly he'd treated his animals. What were the conditions like in Surrey Zoo? Was it improved?
Yes, it was much improved. I mean, the place was much bigger than the Exeter Exchange. It was outside, so there was more room for the animals to roam. And they invested in making it a place to enjoy kind of walking around, and invested in state-of-the-art buildings. And they still weren't really what we'd expect today. So that the glass conservatory that I mentioned was the biggest one in the UK, but it housed lots of different animals. It housed a lot of carnivores, and it housed an aviary. I think it probably would have been quite smelly in there in the height of summer with all these lions and hyenas and things. So yes, the conditions were better, but the animals would still be packed in and weren't kind of free to roam like they are in many zoos today.
Now, you mentioned earlier that, you know, many zoos like London Zoo are still with us today. Obviously, Surrey Zoo isn't, and it didn't actually last the 19th century. What do you think explained the fact that it closed while others didn't?
I think competition was one of the reasons. So kind of later on in the 1840s and 1850s, there were just too many different places that a middle-class Victorian could go for entertainment. Like, they could go to the theatre quite easily. They could go to a music hall show. They could go to other zoos, other kinds of pleasure gardens that maybe didn't have animals. And go to the seaside. There was just so much on offer. I think also perhaps going down the route of investing so much in the entertainments and less so in the animals meant that the place did get a bit run down after a while. And so it then began to seem a bit less fashionable. It wasn't quite as nice a place to go promenading, which had been part of the initial attraction. So Edward Cross, he retired in 1844, and then his successor. So Edward Cross had kind of started the move into these tableaus and the Mount of Vesuvius erupting, things that I've been mentioning, but his successor took it even further. And I think perhaps that was a mistake, kind of not investing in the animals and the surroundings as much, as coupled with the competition from everywhere else.
You mentioned that Surrey Zoo had some really remarkable buildings and gardens. What happened to those after the zoo closed?
Well, Surrey Music Hall was built on the same spot, but it burnt down. And I think most of them have been knocked down and turned into housing now. So Surrey Zoo now is part of it. It's Pasley Park. So there is still some kind of sort of pleasure garden-ish there, but much smaller. So yes, knocked down for housing really.
And from your research into Surrey Zoo, were there any particular episodes or stories from its history that really stood out to you?
Well, yes, a couple. So one of the reasons I started looking at it was because I'm actually a historian of music in the 19th century. And I was looking at the 19th century symphony, so works for full orchestra. And I came across this man called Louis Julien, who was a very charismatic French conductor. And I saw that he conducted symphonies at the Surrey Zoological Garden. I thought, oh, this is quite unusual. So Louis Julien, he was very charismatic. He was quite happy for kind of mythological stories to circulate about himself in the press and didn't kind of bother about correcting anything, and was quite interested in his own PR. So there were stories about how he'd had to come to Britain to escape his Parisian creditors, and he'd been injured in a duel and had to hide out in a farmhouse and run away. And he popularised classical music, really. So he was not really particularly remembered now, but he travelled all around Great Britain conducting classical music in amongst kind of waltzes and polkas and quadrilles, more popular things, and gave people access to kind of Beethoven symphonies for the first time, and conduct these in the zoo opposite the giraffe house, probably all the animals like in the background. And he'd add his own effects. So there might be gunshots during Beethoven's Battle Symphony or fireworks going off, or he used to rattle a jar of peas, dried peas, during the Pastoral Symphony to kind of amplify the storm effects. He'd kind of dress for the occasion with white gloves, sit on a throne, use a jeweled baton, that sort of thing. So that was kind of my way into it. And then when I started looking through these scrapbooks to find out kind of what is the context for these musical performances, then I really got interested in the zoo itself and what it means, what it can tell us about Victorian ideals and what people were doing in the 19th century. And then I kind of turned over a page in the scrapbook and saw this little extract about a man called Charles Green, who I'd never heard of, who ascended in his hot air balloon from a raft in the middle of the lake at Surrey Zoo. And he had a companion called Jacopo, who was a monkey. And Jacopo the monkey parachuted down wearing a smart little red jacket, an especially made parachute, and had a label attached to him saying, if this is property of Surrey Zoological Garden, please return. If found, there's a reward if you can find him. So then I was hooked after reading things like this in the scrapbook. What is this place? What were they doing there? Because it's just so kind of different from like our 21st conception of what a zoo is and what kinds of things you might expect to see it. You might see somebody feeding the animals at a zoo, but you're not going to be parachuting with a monkey. And I found out a bit further and found out that Charles Green was a really famous aeronaut and a record breaker with the distances that he managed to travel in his balloon. And then they had other celebrities coming to the zoo as well. So they had Margaret Graham as well, who was the first British woman to make a solo balloon flight. And they even contacted P.T. Barnum to see if they could borrow some of his acts. They borrowed Tom Thumb, the Lilliputian wonder, they called him, who dressed up as Napoleon, and he went up in the balloon as well. So, yeah, there's all sorts of stories of fascinating things that you could see at the zoo, which obviously are problematic and you wouldn't want to see them now. But they give you a real insight into what people were interested in the 19th century.
And do we know if Jacopo was returned?
Yes, he was. the press reports say that he didn't much seem to relish the ride. I think that's what they said, unsurprisingly. But he's later on recorded as doing it again. Poor thing. So yes, he survived.
And then are there any other broad themes about Victorian Britain that you think the zoo embodies that we haven't discussed yet?
I think Britain's place in the world, I suppose. We've mentioned that about imperialism, but also just kind of being a model in terms of like leading the way forward for zoology, the science of zoology, and also the structures in the zoo. Because even though like London Zoo isn't the first zoo, it is the first zoo of its type, and it did then kind of set the agenda around Europe. So Britain wanting to kind of be interested in progress, wanting to be a leader in all sorts of different areas in the 19th century, the kind of ambition and confidence I think it shows.
That was Dr. Joanne Cormack, Her article on this subject appeared in the January 2023 edition of BBC History magazine and can also be found on our website at historyextra.com/Victorian-zoos.
Thanks for listening to the History Extra podcast. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt.